Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
World order is used in different ways. It's used, as you suggest, by the kind of Bush approach to New World Order after the Cold War, as suggesting that U.S. values and interests were now in a position to dictate to the rest of the world how it should be governed. It's essentially a merger of American grand strategy and the governance of international politics, or global governance, as some sometimes call. I and some people in various parts of the world who I worked with earlier used world order as a way of introducing ethical and normative considerations into our assessment of international politics, and to get away from the realist emphasis on power alone, the kind of Kissingerian view that what counts in the world is hard power. And so we were trying to suggest that world order, properly conceived, consists of trying to promote peace, justice, human rights, and development.
Hey, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the show, how did we get to this moment in time? Of, among other things, skyrocketing inequality, political polarization, the rise of authoritarianism, not only in the U.S., but also abroad, the seeming decline of the neoliberal world order, and, potentially, a new Cold War between the U.S. and China. I turned to a very distinguished scholar in the hopes of getting some answers to those questions. Richard A. Falk is a professor emeritus of international law at Princeton University and a former UN special rapporteur on human rights in the Palestinian territories. He joins us on this edition of the program to discuss the authoritarian turn, not only with Trumpism in America, but also on a global scale in the Philippines, Brazil, and elsewhere. The meaning of the concept of the world order beyond the fevered apocalyptic nightmares of the paranoid style that pervades the right wing today. And to discuss matters of import related to foreign policy, specifically the seeming Washington, D.C. bipartisan consensus on the need for a new Cold War, this time with China. We also briefly discuss the issue of Iran and the Palestine-Israel conflict. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views with international relations scholar, Professor Richard Falk. Welcome to Parallax Views, Professor Emeritus at Princeton University, International Relations Scholar, Richard A. Falk. How are you doing today, Richard?
Pretty well. It's hot here in Turkey, but I'm glad to be with you and glad to be a guest on your program.
So, Professor Falk, I recently came across an essay of yours in Counterpunch from August 25th, 2020, Trumpism, Where Does It Go From Here? And that's the reason I initially reached out to you. But I guess to talk about Trumpism, we would have to talk about how we got here. And obviously, Trumpism as a movement is being seen not just in the U.S., but around the world, a sort of authoritarian surge. How did we get to this moment in time?
Well, that, of course, is a very probing question, and it has no simple answer because the situations of the various countries that have recently opted for this authoritarian political solution vary a great deal from one another. If we just take a few examples, India, Brazil, Philippines, and the U.S. itself. They're very different in their historical outlook, as well as in their capabilities and international role. Their reaction to globalization, I think, is one of the elements that helps to explain not only the rise of authoritarian politics, but also accompanying it, this surge or this new surge of ultranationalism, where the peoples of many countries feel that globalization hasn't given them a good deal. It sees a tiny elite prospering incredibly, but they see themselves in 90-some percent of the population as either in a situation that stagnates or puts them worse off than they were 10 or 20 years earlier. So there's a great deal of anger, and yet very few people know how to focus that anger. And I think these extremist leaders that have been emerging have that kind of street smart capacity to identify scapegoats that can then be associated with the sort of the free-floating rage that is out there in the broader public. And that unites, as in some of these countries, with elite interests in pacifying the society, in militarism, and in maintaining a kind of repressed attitude toward progressive politics.
Not to interrupt you, but so in other words, these leaders that are pushing back or claim to be pushing back on globalization due to these voters and members of the populace who feel screwed by how globalization has turned out, they're actually working with elite interests rather than the other way around.
By and large, I think that's true. Of course, elites are not completely unified.
They're not monolithic. Yeah.
Yeah. They're not monolithic, and there are divisions and fractions. You see it in all of these countries. It's evident in the U.S. at the present time. There are worries that a leader like Trump could produce either an economic collapse or a foreign war of major proportions that He undermines the kind of bipartisan consensus that that governed foreign policy of the U.S. ever since World War II and throughout the whole Cold War, and to some extent even during the Trump presidency, although the it's notable that as in 2016, recently a whole group of Republican national security experts said they couldn't vote for Trump, that they wanted Biden because Biden understood the importance of our alliances, the kind of global security system that had been developed in these years since 1945, and the whole idea that intervention in foreign societies is essential to maintain U.S. primacy, particularly under the conditions posed by the new Chinese challenge, which is a new factor, I think, in the thinking underlying this bipartisan consensus that Biden is a subscriber to.
In that regard, I wanted to mention something very quickly here. When people talk about the world order, I think a lot of folks find the term mystifying, in part because the right wing often talks about the world order in these very conspiratorial and paranoid terms. What do we mean when we say the world order, when we reference things like George H.W. Bush's New World Order speech in the 90s? Because I think it's very different from that sort of right-wing paranoid style.
Yeah, you're quite right to raise that issue. And I think there is a confusion. I mean, it relates in many people's mind to law and order, which is, as you say, a right-wing top agenda priority, particularly these days with the violent urban protests that followed the George Floyd police murder, so that there's a kind of confusion that arises because world order is used in different ways. It's used, as you suggest, by the kind of Bush approach to New World Order after the Cold War as suggesting that U.S. values and interests were now in a position to dictate to the rest of the world how it should be governed. It's essentially a merger of American grand strategy and the governance of international politics, or global governance, as it's sometimes called. I and some people in various parts of the world who I worked with earlier used world order as a way of introducing ethical and normative considerations into our assessment of international politics, and to get away from the realist emphasis on power alone, the kind of Kissingerian view that what counts in the world is hard power. And so we were trying to suggest that world order, properly conceived, consists of trying to promote peace, justice, human rights, and development, and then later ecological sustainability. So it was a kind of value-driven amendment to the realist understanding of how the world operates and how the United States in particular should act within that framework.
It sounds like the sort of world order as you've conceived it would be more, I maybe want to say, humanist, more diplomatic than purely about power and having to obtain that power through any means.
Yes, it's sometimes associated, for instance, with an emphasis on soft power, on, as you say, diplomacy, minimization of recourse to any kind of use of force, the emphasis on human rights as a desirable and stabilizing element in the way states relate to their own societies, and a general way of trying to make the world operate more humanely, more in light of what those who consider themselves progressive would like to see in human relations, how we live together in a better way. We're destined to live together on the planet. The question is, can we improve the ways we live together? The French philosopher Jacques Derrida explored this issue quite innovatively, and I think he's right. He kept posing the question, how do we live together well? And what he meant by that was in a good way rather than in the current destructive and exploitative ways.
Now, in regards to Trumpism, do you see there as being a line leading us to Trumpism from, say, the Bush era and the war on terror to Obama to now?
Well, I think there was an opening. I'm a little bit hesitant to use a fully deterministic view that you can act as if there were history couldn't have unfolded differently. Hillary Clinton ran a very bad campaign in 2016, and if we didn't have the Electoral College, Trump never would have been president.
People often forget it was, you know, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. Most people wanted her, not Trump. It was an Electoral College coup, in a way.
Yes. It's more consistent with the way most people understand enfranchising citizens. This idea that you're a citizen of the state and the state vote should be all or nothing for one candidate, even if the vote is relatively close, is what distorted the outcome from a populist point of view. But it's interesting also to note that the two most populous states in the U.S. were the ones that gave Hillary Clinton this edge, this majority vote, California and New York, the two coastal on either coast, and that it's, you have this situation, I think, of a modern version of what was evident even in biblical times of the city versus the countryside. And the countryside is given disproportionate power because it was so influential at the time the American Republic was established. But we're paying the price, is what I'm trying to say, at the present time for this antiquated way of selecting presidential leaders.
Do you think what do you think the better way of doing elections would be? Not to put you on the spot, but I'm curious if you think there's alternatives or how we could maybe reform the system.
Well, I think there are obvious reforms and then there are more sophisticated considerations. The obvious reform is to abolish the Electoral College and allow the vote to be tabulated on the basis of who wins the most votes, who gets the most support from the public. A more innovative kind of change would be to say that because the U.S. has become a global state, not only Americans, but the citizens of the world should have some kind of participatory role. They're affected by the outcome of American elections because the U.S. with its 800 bases spread around the world and its navies in every ocean really projects a kind of presence. It's not exactly an imperial presence, but it's a global, non-territorial global security system that really disenfranchises much of the world's population. So that would be a second kind of much more radical reform. A third kind, which is in a way less radical, would be to automatically enfranchise everyone over the age of 18 or 21, whatever age was considered sufficiently an age of maturity so that persons could exercise a vote responsibly. And that would eliminate all this gerrymandering and the kind of manipulation of credentials and requirements for voting that really operates to disenfranchise people that are already suffering from social and economic deprivations. Now, so I would put those three ideas out there.
In regards to that city or the sort of coastal elite versus the Trumpist base sort of narrative that we have in our American society and media here, I'm curious as to what you make of that, because I think the response that people have to criticism of the Electoral College is, well, what do you want? Do you just want California to decide the elections? And I'm curious as to how you would respond to that and maybe some of the rage coming out of places that have been dubbed the flyover country of America. Do you think the anger is legitimate? How do we deal with these things?
Well, I think there is certainly a kind of elite snobism that is associated with the two coasts. On the other hand, if you look at those two states, you'll see that the outcome wouldn't reflect this more liberal perspective if you excluded the cities. Again, it reproduces this pattern where the more rural areas, areas with towns under 50,000, let's say, are by and large much more nationalistic and much more susceptible to the lure of a strong leader and suspicious of the kind of elite Wall Street or Washington elites that can be characterized in deservedly negative ways. But I do think that the argument that people don't count equally within a society is a uniquely American argument and doesn't seem to me to be correspond with the major premise of democratic forms of governance.
In regards to that divide as well, so I live in the Rust Belt. I live in Pennsylvania, and I've been very disturbed by some of the very pro-Trump elements arising out of places like Pennsylvania. And yet at the same time, you know, there's an opioid epidemic going on. And, you know, I've had friends from areas like New York and California saying, well, nothing can be done. We need to let these communities die and sort of give them palliative care. And that's where I sort of get mad at the sort of quote unquote coastal elite side of things. Do you think there's a way to pull the rural areas out of that sort of nationalistic mentality and into a more progressive direction, or is that a hopeless cause?
I don't think it's hopeless. At the same time, I think it's quite confusing at the present time. Actually, the digital age should, to some degree, flatten the differences between the countryside and the city. If you had less inequality, you now have this new set of problems of the digital haves and the digital have-nots, which more or less parallels the countryside and the city distinction to begin with, although that too is a generalization because you have in the cities, of course, neighborhoods of extreme poverty and deprivation. So one is dealing with these broad categories that overlook exceptions to their nature, and that would be true in the countryside too. But how you really foster this development is a question that needs a lot more thought. I think the pandemic does make people wonder about the benefits of living in big cities. And I've read that the real estate prices in the suburbs and the outlying areas from these big cities are skyrocketing because people see the disadvantages of being part of this, these urban elite constellations. So I think things are fundamentally changing, but they're changing at a pace and in a way that isn't corresponding with the urgency of the overall global challenges, ranging from climate change to global migration to the health crises, poverty. All these issues cannot be deferred indefinitely. And that's what seems to be happening. While the national elite, the Washington elites, the bipartisan consensus seems to be unifying around this idea of confronting China. And I find that very dangerous and would take energy and resources away from where they're needed and could pose serious risks of military confrontation.
What do you make of the bipartisan consensus on China? What do you think it is arising out of? It seems like everyone's a hawk on China nowadays, whether we're talking about Trump or whether we're talking about Joe Biden, for example. Why is this occurring right now? Is it just a leftover from the Cold War? What's going on there?
Well, I think it represents an unfortunate search for an enemy that in a polarized society seems to be one of the ways of unifying the country. I think that's the Biden approach to this kind of anti-China outlook. And it is a continuation in his case of the kind of global role that the U.S. played ever since World War II. And it had the idea of containing the Soviet Union as the linchpin of its global policies. I think there's a tendency to see China as overtaking the U.S. It's a different kind of adversary than the Soviet Union was, which was seen primarily as a military threat. China is seen, I believe, as more of an economic and technological threat. It has managed this extraordinary growth over the last half century that is the most remarkable developmental achievement of all of modern history. And it combines that with challenging the technological frontiers in ways that no non-Western country has managed to do previously. And that creates what sometimes has been referred to as the Thucydides trap, whereas where a country that had been ascendant is being challenged by an overtaking second power. And rather than be overtaken, it tries to defeat that challenger before it becomes ascendant. And so Graham Allison of Harvard has written a book with that title, The Thucydides Trap, where he talks about past historical instances in which this kind of tension has occurred, going back to the ancient Greeks, where the name comes from, where Athens was threatened by Sparta and engaged in self-destructive warfare and actually collapsed as a consequence.
It's interesting one of the terms that I've used a lot is the multipolar world. It seems like, you know, after the fall of the Soviet Union, there was this idea that it's a unipolar world now, that the U.S. is the not just the superpower, but the hyperpower. And it seems like after the war on terror and the Bush era, that starts changing. And we're seeing it change even more now with China. But I'm not sure that a lot of folks in Washington, D.C., for example, want to let go of that idea of the unipolar world. Do you think we are living in a multipolar world now where there's multiple powers?
Well, I think it depends on what sort of emphasis you give to those questions. If you look at it from a strictly military point of view, you can make a good case that the U.S. is spending eight times what the nearest other state is spending on military capabilities. And if that's the measure of how the world is run, then the unipolar image still has a certain kind of credibility. But if you look at technological innovative capabilities, the 5G network to enhance communications and interconnectedness, or if you look at the quality of social life, economic life, the world does look much more multipolar. And and since China is not a hard power competitor, it also creates a much more confusing diffusion of influence and leverage. And they've expanded by trade, investment, by penetrating other societies through win-win kinds of strategies, building their railroad or harbors and infrastructure development, and then gaining influence by doing that. And that's very different from establishing a military base in a foreign country and training the military of that country. And so I think you have this new kind of confrontation with lots of space left regionally for other kinds of developments to occur. And Trump, for all of his bluster and geopolitical arrogance, has actually withdrawn from some of these alliances that gave the unipolar world its diplomatic infrastructure. So in some way, part of the reason the Washington elites are uncomfortable with Trump is that he undermines their version of unipolarity. And so it's a complicated kind of issue, I think.
I was going to mention in that regard, I always found it interesting that when Obama became president, there was talk from his national security advisor, Ben Rhodes, about the administration's issues with what he called the DC blob in reference to foreign policy. There were attempts made to really push forward a Russian reset. How do you think Obama stacks up compared to Biden? Do you think there's been a sort of change there with regards to the Democrats? Do you think there was maybe more of a chance for accepting a multipolar world under Obama?
I do think so, especially under early Obama. I think when Obama first became president, he thought that he had more room for political maneuver in foreign policy. You remember he gave these two speeches in the Middle East, one in Cairo, which advocated a new approach to Israel-Palestine, and the other in Prague, where he proposed a world without nuclear weapons. He backed off both those visionary initiatives because he discovered that if he wanted to govern effectively with regard to domestic priorities, he had to give way to this bipartisan consensus. And the bipartisan consensus is pro-nuclear, pro-military, and pro-Israeli, and pro-capitalist, of course. And there was no way he found, and was unwilling at least, to really challenge in any sustained way those deeply embedded interests that really underlie the lobbying and the kind of Washington swamp that Trump in his 2016 campaign talked about, but really succumbed to as president.
Now, I want to get into the risk factors here with regards to the election. I guess let's start with Joe Biden and then move to Trump. What do you think the risks are with regards to a Biden presidency and some of his policy ideas? There's already talk from his transition team that they're just going to go with austerity after the election. I think that's one concern. What do you think, though?
Well, I think on foreign policy, it is the new Cold War with the focus, maybe a dual focus on Russia and China, and an attempt to revive the NATO-Atlanticist alliance as the cornerstone of American security policy, as well as a possibly less aggressive approach to Iran and Middle Eastern issues. So in that sense, he presents a slightly less risky prospect. Domestically, I think he's very much, as would have been the case with Hillary Clinton, deferential to what one might call the Wall Street or the Goldman Sachs view of the world.
Well, would you agree that the sort of Clinton Democrats and the Biden Democrats, they're still holding on to this sort of third way neoliberalism where, oh, well, the private sector can do things like welfare better and that sort of mentality?
Yes, I think so. Though they may be somewhat influenced, at least in the short run, by the Black Lives Matter surge of socioeconomic grievances. And I think they will try in a way that Trump wouldn't to ameliorate those grievances. Whether they'll do anything that's structural that will deal with so-called systemic racism is rather doubtful. But they will do things that seem to respond to grievances connected with police brutality and with failure to uphold the civil rights of people of color.
Now, are there any other concerns that we should have with a Biden presidency, or do you generally see it as those are the main issues?
I think they're the main issue. It depends. See, I think there's an uncertainty as to whether this aroused sense of social and racial grievance will become quickly dissatisfied with the too moderate initiatives and will try to push the Biden presidency beyond where it wants to go. And that will pose this choice: either they act in a kind of repressive way, if they're real mass protests, or they give rise to a new kind of neo-fascist response to what is being called violent disorder in the cities. So I think how they manage these kind of grievances that have surfaced since the Floyd incident will be very crucial to the stability and the success of a Biden presidency.
I was going to add in that regard, I feel as if people sometimes under-discuss the differences within the Democratic Party. There's this progressive wing that we know for sure is not a big fan of Joe Biden. They're very unenthusiastic. And for all the talk of unity that is being pushed now out of, after the Democratic National Convention, you have the progressives on one end who distrust the Biden camp. And I would say that moderate Democrats who feel that we need to appeal to sort of the suburban element of society, suburban homeowners, I feel that they're afraid of the progressives. And, you know, their constituency is afraid that, oh, progressives are going to usher in socialism of some sort. Would you agree with that assessment, that they're both sides fear each other?
Absolutely. You know, I live, when I'm in the U.S., I live in Santa Barbara, which is a place where you see what I call Montecito Democrats. That is, people that want a humane kind of social policy, but are more worried about their portfolio, their stocks and bonds. And so one's not sure what they hated Sanders and feared him. And they might even worry about a Biden that is too beholden to this progressive wing. And how that plays out is very tricky. But you're absolutely right. The Democrats that are the funding base of the policy party are definitely not progressive. They're liberal in, as I say, social policy. They want people treated decently. They want decent judicial appointments. They like the bipartisan consensus, basically. But they are driven by material interests. And therefore, if they see those interests challenged, they get very nervous. And they were very nervous when it looked like Sanders was going to be the nominee, which it did look for a moment. And I'm absolutely convinced that a lot of the people I know in Santa Barbara, even though what they claim to hate Trump, and they do, would either not vote or would vote for Trump and under those conditions.
I guess what confuses me about that is that, I mean, we have skyrocketing inequality. We have opioid epidemics in parts of the country like Pennsylvania here. Wouldn't the concern be for those type of Democrats who maybe are a little bit more well off, wouldn't they have the foresight to say, well, if we want to prevent social upheaval, then maybe we have to give a little bit more to the progressives to prevent that from happening? Or do you think that's just a blind spot?
No, I think you have a lot of variation, even among the more so-called moderate or independent Democrats. And many of them would say modest reforms of the tax structure are justified and necessary, even for the reasons you say, to keep more radical social movements from gaining political traction. So there is definitely a sense that one needs to find a formula for combining a degree of social justice and a reduction of inequality with a stable capitalist order, a neoliberal order. And Obama was trying to do that, I think. That's what he wanted to do. But the trick is when you're up against it, it seems as if you don't have that flexibility, that you either have to go in this direction that has led to all the inequality, which is the neoliberal globalization path, or you have to challenge it in fairly fundamental ways that don't punish the Rust Belt and other parts of the country in the ways that globalization did in the 1990s during the Clinton presidency, where the whole triumphalism after the collapse of the Soviet Union was translated into a kind of globalism that really punished a lot of people, working class people. And I think part of the rage that I described earlier is a consequence of that, being feeling forgotten and not taking the trouble and the going to the expense of adapting those that were affected by these changes to a better future for themselves through education, training program. There was very little done to ease the negative impacts of giving priority to the efficiency of capital rather than the well-being of people. And that's what neoliberalism in its most robust phases and then after the end of the Cold War, that's what I believe is underlying a lot of the malaise that we're now experiencing.
I guess that's a good segue into the risks that we face with another Trump presidency. I've had a few guests on say, well, you know, there's the second term curse. Usually second termers don't get a lot done. But seeing the way Trump treats even the White House, you know, press team, the reporters, I get very concerned. What do you make of a second Trump term? What would it look like? And what do you think we should be on guard for?
Well, I think we should, above all, be on guard for what is best, I think, described or understood as a slide toward an American version of fascism. I mean, I think that's the danger he poses by denigrating the press, by overriding the limits of law on the way in which presidential power should be exercised, by his various economic dealings, so that there are a lot of things, and by his kind of demagogic style, which is which he's very skilled at using to create hostility toward those that he wants to blame for failures of his own. So I think that I would put that cluster of concerns as primary, and the secondary cluster would be that he pushes toward a kind of Israeli-Saudi hegemony in the Middle East that ends up with a kind of war with Iran and or a strong effort at regime change in Iran. I think he wants to leave a legacy in which he shows that there was a discontinuity between his presidency and everyone that came before him since World War II, either Republican or Democrat. And related to that is the sense that he can create a presidential dynasty and have a relative or, you know, Ivanka or somebody that is very closely connected with him succeed him. You know, the Republican, some Republicans talk about the next 12 years, you know, not just the next 4 years. And so that's all part, I think, of the present risk factor.
I guess before we close out, I wanted to get your opinion on, since you mentioned Iran, I've never quite understood why Iran would be our enemy after the war on terror, because they're Shia dominated. So it seems like they would be an ally against Wahhabist Sunni jihadists. Maybe you could explain your thoughts on how we deal with Iran. And also, if you could, you were involved with the UN as a special rapporteur on Palestine. What do you think is going to happen to Palestine? I feel like a lot of people have given up.
Yes, you posed two big questions, two big areas. I mean, the Iran policy is very confusing, and not many people understand that issue that you raised, which is that not only is there the sectarian split between Shiism and Sunniism, but Iran was the prime actor against terrorism in the region. They were most threatened by it, and they were most anti-ISIS and did a lot to curtail. They were, in some ways, a natural ally. But you have to look back at how this governing process in Iran got started, which was a reaction against the Shah of Iran, a form of monarchy that had been imposed on a democratically elected government back in 1953 in a coup that the U.S. was involved with. And ever since 1953 up till 78, 79, when the Iranian Revolution occurred and Khomeini came to run Iran, it was seen as a kind of extension of American foreign policy, important in the Cold War and containing the Soviet Union, important because it cooperated in supplying Israel with oil and South Africa with oil, things that were not popular for the U.S. to try to do directly. So it was what Henry Kissinger once called the rarest of things, an unconditional ally. And for that reason, Khomeini and the Iranian Revolution, from its inception, viewed the U.S. as their enemy. And this was reinforced by the sense that the expression of Western interference with the Islamic world was epitomized by the creation of the State of Israel in the midst of the Arab countries, and that this had to be challenged and changed if the colonial era was to be ended. Khomeini's thought is quite interesting if one looks at it not through the Islamic optic, but from the optic of post-colonial history and ideology, because he had a very clear vision of the degree to which the region had been subjugated by colonial interests after World War I, where France and the UK divided the Ottoman Empire up into colonial fiefdoms for their own interests, and prevented what he regarded as the much more real non-territorial Islamic civilization from emerging its in a way that created its own political forms. So the long story is that Iran, from its from the time of its revolution, which is now over 40 years, has seen the U.S. as its enemy, and Israel has seen Iran as its enemy, and Israel has a lot of influence over U.S. foreign policy. And so these kinds of factors explain an irrational form of conflict where there should be a much greater recognition of a harmony of interests. And Obama, I think, was moving in that direction with the agreement in 2015 on moving toward normalization and the control of the nuclear weapons program of Iran. But Trump went all in on the Saudi-Iran sectarian approach to dealing with Iran, so-called maximum pressure, and creating a situation where he repudiated the 2015 Obama agreement and moved toward a much more confrontational approach. As far as Israel-Palestine is concerned, the developments may be somewhat less unfavorable to Palestine than appearances suggest. And I say this because I think there's still a great deal of support for the Palestinian struggle at the level of people or society. And it's these regimes that are very isolated from their own societies that have moved toward in the direction of normalizing their acceptance of Israel in their presence and bonding with Israel in the anti-Iran confrontation. Civil society, I think, is increasingly convinced, including Jews in the US, that the Palestinians have been treated abysmally and deserve a much more, a much fairer way of being treated in their own country. They've become strangers in their own society, subject to a regime, a security regime that has all the characteristics of apartheid in the sense of one ethnicity subjugating another ethnicity through coercive and exploitative means. And that, in my view, was inevitable in the Zionist project because Israel was the only country that had a colonial process of establishment in the era of decolonization. In other words, the Zionist project was extremely successful in reversing the flow of anti-colonial history. But it had to do it, it could only do it by suppressing Palestinian nationalism coercively from the beginning. And it wanted to be democratic. It wanted to have an Israeli democracy in order to legitimate the new state. And to do that, it had to get rid of a lot of Palestinians. So from the very beginning of the Israeli narrative was the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians living in Palestine. As many as 750,000 were for one reason or another, were forced out of Palestine, Israeli Palestine anyway, in 1948, and most significantly, denied any right of return. And it's that kind of stark injustice that I think won't let the Palestinian struggle die after all this period. So it's unpredictable what will happen. The region is unstable, and it may produce quite unexpected reversals of political power in the decade ahead. So we really don't know what will happen. But I think my observations while I was UN Special Rapporteur is that the Palestinians are suffering from a very prolonged ordeal and that they are very dedicated to not treating their situation as a lost cause. But it won't be resolved by intergovernmental or UN initiatives primarily. It will depend on populist movements in the Arab countries and by global solidarity initiatives and by new forms of Palestinian resistance.
I want to let you go, Professor Folk, but I always like to end on a positive note. Are there any hopes you have for the future? I mean, we've been talking about new Cold Wars and income inequality and whether elites will actually, you know, give a little to stop income inequality. Do you think there is any hope beyond that darkness?
Yes, I think there's the hope that rests in the objective circumstances of the world, that to the extent that the human species once can act collectively on behalf of its own survival, it needs to move toward a more unified, more peaceful world that can act effectively to deal with the common good, with common challenges, challenges to our ecological sustainability, challenges to our social and economic and political viability. So I see from all those perspectives one important source of hope. And the other source of hope is the failure of militarism in situations where military superiority has not been translated into political outcomes. The Americans resisted learning this lesson in Vietnam and repeated the difficulties of that failure in Iraq and in Afghanistan to a different degree. So in other words, I think what we can learn is that militarism isn't the path to security that it had been in previous eras. And that could open up a whole new domain for the political and moral imagination to find better ways to solve problems and to institute more effective forms of global governance.
Well, thank you, Professor Falk, for coming on Parallax Views. It has been a fascinating hour, and I hope you'll agree to maybe come back on the program at some point in the future. I really enjoyed having you on.
Thank you. You asked very good questions and challenged me in the best possible ways. So I look forward to talking with you in the future.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Professor Richard A. Falk. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. And of course, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. Producers credit shoutouts to Amelia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Ted, Zach, and Gratz. If you'd like your own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, please join them in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tier on the Parallax Views Patreon page at, again, patreon.com/parallaxviews. Believe it or not, it is my Patreon that allows this show to keep moving forward. Although I get a little bit of advertising revenue, it is not nearly enough to sustain this program, and I am looking to increase the number of Patreon supporters for the show this month. I really need a push here, as everyone, including myself, is a bit tight on cash, and I want to keep this program going. So if you can, please consider supporting me on patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.